5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All right, lift off and the clock has started. Yes, sir, reading you loud and clear.
Ask a rocket scientist.
Oxygen, go. All systems are go.
Welcome to this very special edition of Ask a Rocket Scientist, Avengers Endgame Edition. Here is the podcast where we answer questions about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Now, here is the deal. We have not seen Endgame yet. There are zero spoilers in this podcast. In fact, we're recording it a couple days before Endgame comes out. So we will not be talking about that film at all on any level. But we will be discussing the other... How many are there, Eddie? How many are there, Oliver? Talking to the microphone.
About like 21.
I think there's 21 other. By the way, that's Eddie, my son. Say hi.
Hello.
And then that's Oliver. Say hi, buddy.
Hi, buddy.
Hi. He's going to be the smart aleck of the podcast. And then Bill, of course, is here. Bill, thank you so much for coming over to my house to do this. We're normally at Bill's because it's a little bit quieter, but we need the rowdiness here.
Absolutely.
For this episode. Okay, so what we want to do is we're going to toss just a couple questions, things that have popped into our minds, me and Eddie and Oliver, about the Marvel Universe, and see if you can help us. Oliver, what's the first thing that you'd like to ask Bill?
In Infinity War, there's those guys that show up on Earth with the donut ship.
Mm-hmm.
Could you do that?
What do you mean, could you do that?
Could you?
Like donut ships? Like, could ships that are circular,
yeah,
like that, fly? Uh-huh. Because it's a really good question, because normally when we think of flying... We think of what we have here on Earth,
right,
airplanes,
right,
space shuttles, rocket ships that are just... But in the Marvel Universe, we're just seeing all kinds of crazy different shaped aircraft and
spacecraft.
Right, helicarriers
to every spaceship known to man.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you could even broaden that out to Star Trek, Star Wars. I mean, anything flies.
Apparently. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, anything fly. I think the question would be is like, what's powering it? Like, why? How does it hover?
Yeah.
Right, if it relied on, you know, if it's say a helicopter, that's, you know, when we on Earth have to make something hover, it's very difficult to make something large do that, like these spaceships. But if we're going to go into the way out land.
Yeah, well, because what I wonder about the circular ship that we're talking about in Infinity War is with most ships, we see rockets. Like, even if you think about the space shuttle on the back of it, they've got the engines that are burning.
Right.
But this is a circle.
Yeah.
It's like, where does the propulsion come from? There's
Right. Man, I don't know. That's the old science fiction. We'll just use this little device over here. It miraculously works.
How would you steer the ship? Because that's pretty hard.
Yeah. So that's one that's, I think, honestly, in most of these movies, there's a little willful suspension of disbelief. Because physics says for every action, there has to be an equal and opposite reaction. So if you're pushing off one side, you'd expect to see something doing the pushing. So what they're actually using, I'm not certain. You know, sometimes you'll see, like, you know, the old school rockets or some sort of exhaust gas or flames or...
Yeah, because most of the other spaceships that we see, like the one that Peter Quill has, the Guardians of the Galaxy, it's your standard operating spaceship.
It has engines on the back.
It looks like a normal spaceship.
It has wings and engines, so it implies that, oh, somehow it can fly in the atmosphere and somehow it has rockets to move you in space.
Yeah.
So maybe a little more reality or plausibility.
Yeah, so... I have another question. So if you were to have like powers, say like the Hulk, would you be able to like have that much power and stay alive? Like, could your body take that much gamma radiation?
Well, simple answer to the gamma radiation is no. It's kind of lethal. So I'm going to quote you an article I found on that, which I thought was kind of an entertaining way of making a long story short.
By the way, just a brief aside, some of these some of this information is coming from articles and YouTube videos that we found. We're going to put links to all this stuff on our show page at the website, iHeartRocketScience.com. And when you go to iHeartRocketScience.com, click on this episode and you'll get all kinds of information, video links and article links and things like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
All right, Bill, what'd you find?
So your question actually brings up two sub-questions. One would be, if you were that big, I mean, how would you survive? I mean, can you imagine the amount of calories you'd have to be eating? We'll get back to that one.
Yeah.
The gamma radiation question, actually, when you start digging up gamma radiation, I didn't even know this, but gamma radiation is bad stuff.
It is no bueno.
It is way no bueno. It's way off the ultraviolet end of the spectra. So the fact that the Hulk is green does not mean gamma radiation is green. It's we can't see ultraviolet, but it's way off that end of the spectra. But to put it gently, and I'm quoting an article from Live Science, to put it gently, a gamma bomb in the real world would not turn Bruce Banner into the Incredible Hulk. Rather, it would likely quickly turn him into a corpse dead from radiation sickness, if not incinerating him instantly. So gamma radiation packs, it's 10,000 times more energy dense than what we get from the sun.
Good Lord. Wait, 10,000?
10,000, yeah.
So you know how you got a sunburn a couple years ago, Oliver, at the beach?
That was bad.
It was not good. Imagine 10,000 times that. Or you get a sunburn 10,000 times quicker. That bad.
Well, that'd be very fast.
Yes.
Very
bad. Yes, it would. Yes.
That would not be fun.
So here's another article that kind of puts into, puts into reference on what it would take to get a lot of gamma radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just back up to the beginning of this little, it's just a simple paragraph. So there are three types of radiation: alpha rays, beta rays, and gamma rays. Alpha and beta rays are easily stopped by paper, clothes, and skin. Gamma rays are the bad ones. It takes a few inches of lead or a few feet of concrete and dirt to slow them or stop them. A detonating nuclear device will produce a lot of gamma rays. Even if the blast doesn't kill you, the radiation dosage could be very high. And no bueno.
Are you open for a follow-up question?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Is gamma radiation able to make you stronger as it does with the Hulk?
I would suspect not. I think that's Marvel having fun. Because if gamma radiation was really as dangerous as we know it to be, I don't know, Bruce Banner might have had just the magical amount and maybe his body reacted in just the right way. But I don't know why it would cause him to turn into the Hulk.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also keep in mind that when the brilliant geniuses at Marvel came up with the Hulk, it was the early 1960s, I believe, the Hulk originated. And this was after World War II when we had nuclear bombs and everybody was wondering about nuclear radiation and all different kinds of radiation, how it could mutate things. That's when we got the movie right. Godzilla and all those giant creatures, Rodan and Mothra, all came out in the 50s following World War II when we had nuclear weapons. So I don't know how much we really knew about gamma radiation. I mean, I imagine our knowledge about gamma rays has increased tremendously over the last 50 or 60 years. Right. So just keep in mind, when the Hulk was created, the character was created.
Right.
Maybe they thought that we could survive it.
Right. We go back to the early 1900s and they didn't know. And that's actually what they believe killed Madame Curie.
Hmm.
You know, because she was doing all the radiation experiments without really knowing what she was exposing herself to.
Right. So, right.
But where do gamma rays actually come from? They come from solar flares, eruptions from sun surface, pulsars, which are rotating objects that regularly emit radiation, nova, supernova emissions, explosions, celestial objects.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
So are they like the sun's rays in that they're around us all the time, just in micro doses? Or is it a type of thing where you would need to go out of your way to get exposed to gamma radiation?
Yeah, I think we're protected by our atmosphere here.
Got it.
Like solar flares, if you were an astronaut on orbit outside the Earth's magnetosphere, yeah, you could get pretty well cooked outside. Like if you're on a lunar mission, you have no protection other than the ship.
Yeah, so Bill and I have actually talked about this in a previous episode. If you go to the moon or go to Mars, you're at a heightened risk of getting radiation because you're not protected by the Earth's atmosphere anymore. So radiation is pounding your body. It's pounding the ship. So all the ships have to have radiation protection. There has to be protection. So that's like another question that we had. Ask about the, Oliver, ask your question that you came up with about Peter Quill rescuing Gamora. Remember we talked a little bit about that? Or was that Eddie's question? All right. Sorry, Eddie. Go ahead. Sorry, Oliver. So you'll get your turn.
So I had another question. Sorry, Oliver. So in Guardians of the Galaxy, the first one, Gamora is...
She's the green woman. Yeah. I'm going to kind of fill in the gap for people that aren't 100% certain of who all the characters are.
Yeah, she's the green lady that's really awesome. So she's on Planet Doom, which is the big, like, scavenger place. And so she goes off the planet in like this little pod, and so she can't survive outside with that little pod, so I guess like she jumps out or something, and then
Oliver, you go ahead and chime in.
She was blown up. Somebody blew up her ship, Betty. That's the whole reason she was in space.
Okay, Oliver, shut up.
and
just
she was not
microphone
on she was not on Planet Doom, Eddie. She was on Planet Nowhere, and they were chasing somebody. They were running away from somebody because they had the Infinity Stone, and that person shot her ship, she blew up, she was in space, Quill got out of his ship to save her.
But then now, what's Eddie's question?
Okay, so...
So Oliver's given us the backstory, because he's an encyclopedia about all of this. So what's your question?
Okay, so when Peter Quill jumps out of the spaceship, he obviously has his mask on at the time. But then he takes off, like, is behind his ear or something, and he puts it on...
Hold the microphone close to your face.
Yeah, so he puts it, puts it, like, on her ear... And then presses the button to make it go on her.
So in essence, he gives her
his spacesuit.
His helmet.
Yeah, his helmet, his oxygen supply, and everything.
So I know that that he's like a celestial and all, but like, could a normal human being survive for a good like 7 seconds like he did?
You know, surprisingly, actually the answer is yes. So science fiction has all sorts of fun with this, but it turns out there's... good reason to believe you could survive for a limited amount of time.
Limited meaning, like Eddie, 7 seconds, 30 seconds,
yeah,
couple minutes?
Some of these articles actually talk about some experiments that were done in the past on, kind of crazily, on living creatures in vacuum chambers on how long they could actually survive and come back without actually seeming to have any long-term damage. So,
go ahead, Eddie.
Go ahead.
Sorry. His face was, like, also freezing over, so that kind of... That doesn't really make sense, because when he was... When, like, the beam thing, whatever you call that, when he goes... When he gets pulled into the scavenger ship...
It's like a tractor beam kind of thing?
Yeah, the tractor beam. It pulls him into the ship, and then when he gets in the ship, it's all gone, which is probably just a movie magic book. Yeah.
Space is very cold, Eddie.
It's true.
Ships are not.
So there's a number of questions.
But could it melt that fast?
Yes, because you're
Oliver.
Because you're going from the very cold to very hot. Like when you put ice in hot chocolate, it melts.
Keep going, Oliver.
The hot chocolate is much warmer than the ice.
Mm-hmm.
So the ice is like space, and the hot chocolate is like.
So what did you want to say, Eddie?
But it was like. Maybe 4 seconds, like 4 seconds between him out there, the tractor beam hitting him, the tractor beam hitting him and then pulling him back into the ship. Like, my question is, with your analogy with the ice cube and the hot chocolate, it takes a good, like, 10, 15 seconds for the ice to completely melt in the hot chocolate. But it took like 4 to 5 seconds for it to melt off of his face in the ship.
Okay, Eddie. I'm pretty sure space is way colder than a cube of ice. So, you would be way much colder.
Which means it would take longer.
Which means it would take less
Mic
time.
Drop. Keep going, Ollie.
Because you're going from very cold to kind of... very much the opposite of space, quickly, so you would melt.
So there's some physics involved in this question.
Can we get our scientist involved in this?
It's not evident in space movies because they portray space as always been cold, and we know it's cold, but there's also no atmosphere. There's no you're in a vacuum, so that means
which means there's no air, there's no oxygen, there's
right,
nothing.
Nothing. Right. It is cold in space, but you don't freeze immediately. That's a myth. You know, you have to have some sort of atmosphere around you in order to conduct or convect things that quickly. But what's really going to kill you is if you were to hold your breath and then hit a vacuum, yeah, you're doomed. Because your body can stretch. That wouldn't be the problem. It's just your lungs now are suddenly in a very high pressure situation. You blow air bubbles in your system, much like a diver, scuba diver is really trying to avoid doing. You kill yourself that way. You just blew air bubbles into your system. So they say, okay, that would be bad. But if you were to exhale, end up in space, you wouldn't explode. You're not going to, you know, like movie magic, you're not going to just explode or pop. Doesn't happen. But you only have enough oxygen in your bloodstream to last about 15 seconds. So if you can't do something to save yourself in 15 seconds, you got a problem because you're going to just pass out.
So just before, in this situation, Peter Quill's got his mask on, he's got his oxygen supply. If he went and then took off the mask and gave it to Gamora,
He would have blown his lungs out.
Okay, so if he's doing this, but if he goes
He's got to empty his lungs first.
He's got to empty his lungs. Yeah. Then get. So you don't want to have oxygen in your body.
You don't want to have pressure. That's the thing.
Okay, lungs, so you want to blow out the oxygen and get everything out of your system. Yeah. And then when he gives her the headset, which then provides life support for her, he then...
Well, now he's in trouble because he has no oxygen. So he's got his 15-second timer is going.
Okay, and, but okay, so something that Oliver just did a few moments ago is he held his breath. That you heard him do was him exhaling. And so let me ask this part. If Peter Quill exhales, let's say when you exhale, you can go 30 seconds, 60 seconds, a minute and a half without having to take a breath. You know, it's just like if you're going underwater when the kids go swimming. So does that determine how long you'll survive in outer space? Like if you can hold your breath normally for 90 seconds, will you survive 90 seconds in space? Or are the conditions so intense that 15 or 20 seconds your body starts to go, oh, I got it?
Well, one advantage when you're holding your breath, you've got a whole lung full of oxygen to feed from.
Correct.
You do not, if you were to even survive the first chuck you out the airlock, because I didn't all over having a fight on a space station. One of them opens the airlock and says, you're out of here.
Yeah.
Well, you want to empty your lungs, so you don't have that reservoir of oxygen to help you. You're purely living on what's in your blood at the time, so you don't have anything else. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty unanimous. Every article I read says you've got 15 seconds before you deplete all the oxygen in the blood.
Got it.
So here's a real quick paragraph that was on a website called Science Focus that pretty well summarizes this. When asked, you know, could you survive without a spacesuit, they said, surprisingly, you would not. You probably would not explode. Skin is almost completely gas tight and strong enough to withstand a pressure differential of well over one atmosphere. You also wouldn't instantly freeze. In a vacuum, the only way to lose heat is by radiation, which occurs very slowly for a relatively cool object like the human body, or by evaporation of a fluid. And you're not going to really have those in space. You would still die, of course, but it would be due to asphyxiation. Your blood holds enough oxygen for about 15 seconds of brain activity. After that, you'd black out with complete brain death following within 3 minutes. But if you're rescued within the first 30 seconds, you'd probably have nothing worse than bruises over your body and skin. Do not try to hold your breath before they throw you out, though. The air in your lungs will cause your lung tissue to rupture quite abruptly as it expands into your chest cavity, forcing air bubbles into your bloodstream. This would be fatal even if you are subsequently rescued.
Okay, so fellas, chance are good Bill and I are never going to get into space because we're too old, but you guys are young enough that who knows, you may end up in space. If you ever get captured by space pirates and they kick you out of the ship, make sure to exhale before you go out. Go, blow out, because that'll give you 15 or 20 seconds to survive. Otherwise, you're just going to detonate. Yeah. It's no good.
Bad juju. But you don't explode.
You don't explode.
No bueno.
Internally, your organs are like, mama, and they start cracking down. That's no good. Okay, we're going to take a quick little break, very quick little break. We'll be back with more Marvel-related science questions from my two sons, Oliver and Eddie. And the legendary Bill Scaff, rocket scientist, here in just a moment. This episode of Ask a Rocket Scientist is brought to you by convincing your kids to actually talk to human beings instead of just looking everything up on the internet. Yeah, they come to me with science questions. I don't have the answers. So what do? I get a real live human being who actually knows what he's talking about to sit down with my kids and answer their questions. Sure, they could easily look up online, Google or Bing if you're still using that. But a conversation with an actual person who's an expert on something? Oh my goodness, what a great experience for your kids. Convincing your kids to have conversations with actual human beings. Thank you for sponsoring this episode. All right, back to the show. Okay, we're back. Ask a Rocket Scientist. I'm here with Bill Scaff, as usual. My name is Chuck. I'm here with my boys, Oliver and Eddie. And we're talking about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So we have more Marvel-related questions. Oliver, what's the next one that you have that's picking your brain?
So in the movie Thor and Thor the Dark World, there's this character Heimdall who stands at Asgard and sends like a beam of stuff that makes Thor come from, like, say he's on Earth, he goes from Earth to Asgard like super quickly, and then scientists just found out that there's wormholes in space. They call it the Bifrost, the thing that sends Thor to Asgard. Is that similar to the Bifrost?
So, let's jump back in the Wayback Machine. There's a super genius scientist named Einstein who came up with theory of general relativity, which there's no simple way to summarize that except that it explains space and time and everything around us and in a grand scale. And his theory actually predicts the existence of wormholes.
Yeah, and we've actually talked about wormholes once or twice before in previous episodes, of which you should download and listen to if you haven't heard them yet. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay. So with Einstein's field equations, they when they looked at it from a mathematical basis, you know, it's hard to get a physical interpretation for those equations. Well, at one point, it was realized that those equations might predict something like two black holes with a tunnel between them, and in which case you can go from point A to B.
Interesting. Okay, so Einstein, with his theory of relativity, it has been interpreted in some ways that there can be these fields in space, just these holes that open up, and they're connected somehow.
Right, right. And they're mathematically feasible. However, they aren't necessarily plausible.
What's the bridge called?
The Einstein-Rosen bridge.
I think Jane Foster talked about that in one of the Thor movies.
Yeah, in the Thor movie, that's their perception, is when we see it, in the movie, it's just Heimdall twisting his sword open, creating the Bifrost, which allows residents of Asgard to travel from planet to planet. And they can go to different places. It's not just Asgard to Earth. It's Asgard to wherever.
Right.
But when it appears on Earth, Natalie Portman's character refers to it as the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Bridge. What's it called?
Einstein-Rosen Bridge.
Thank you. Yeah. Like, they actually reference that a couple times in the movie. So next time you watch any of the Thor movies and they mention the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Bridge, you'll know what they're talking about. That's a relationship to Einstein.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Gotcha. So we don't know, obviously, that. So the Bifrost is grounded in theoretical science,
right,
in something that we think could be real, but obviously we haven't proven. We're not creating wormholes.
No, we haven't found one. You know, it's the math predicts the existence of it rather than we found one.
Got it. Okay. So Einstein, the super genius, says these could exist. And other scientists have kind of looked at his math and said, yeah, I guess that's right. Yeah. So that nobody's like said that he's crazy about this, right?
No.
It is a real possibility that these exist. Okay. Mathematically. All right. So sorry, Oliver. We're not going to be able to go to Asgard anytime soon.
Okay.
Super bummer. Oliver's so bummed. Now he's going to mope off.
Dude.
Oh, he's so sad. All right, Eddie, your question. What's next?
Okay. So, I have another question. I know I've been asking a lot of questions, but here's another one.
That's what this is about, bro.
Yeah.
That's why you're sitting here with Bill.
Okay. So, in like all of the Avengers and one of the Captain America movies and obviously all of the Iron Man movies, Iron Man has this really awesome suit that's just blasts things and it's really cool. Has any military like people, I guess, been trying to figure this out and actually make an exoskeleton that is able to, one, shoot things, and two, like, actually, well, you know, protect the person that is inside of it, like, well enough to not kill them.
Yeah, so is there armor that somebody could put on where they could walk into a firefight with guns and just not get killed? It's bulletproof. And then they also possess some of the other skills of Iron Man's suits, like there's weapons and things.
It has like blasters in the hands and
launches
like missiles
from the shoulders. What are you kidding me?
And then it also provides like super strength and stuff, so mm-hmm. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, so where are we at on that technology, Bill?
Oh, good question. Not that far. There are any number of companies working on exosuits for soldiers, and if Iron Man is a 10 on the scale, let's tone it back to about a 2.
Gotcha.
They're doing, you know, obviously.
So if Iron Man's at a 10, if Iron Man is the pinnacle of what we're shooting for, right now we're just
like a 1.
A 1 or 2. Yeah.
We're back down the scale.
Yeah, we've got soldiers wearing football pads right now. We're trying to make those bulletproof. Exactly. That's kind of where we're at right now.
Exactly. So the armor aspect is one aspect, and obviously we'd like to protect soldiers from harm's way. So, you know, bullets, knives, you know, the
IEDs,
weapons. Exactly.
Shrapnel.
And, you know, that's probably the most prevalent use for it right now is just the armor aspect. But
go ahead, Eddie.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So there's also another possibility.
Microphone, please.
There's also another possibility that, like, say, we were in a battle, and they wanted to use an exoskeleton. If you can't tell, I'm sick. That a person, like, activates an EMP, like a...
Big word. Do you know what that stands for?
Electromagnetic pulse.
All right.
The Marvel Universe is teaching you boys very important things.
And, they snuck Pacific science Rim. Into plot.
And yeah. Pacific Rim.
And Pacific Rim.
Yeah. Okay.
Keep going.
So, like, how would they prevent that? How would they prevent the suit from just completely shutting down if that happened?
It's a problem because EMPs are very nondescript. They fry everything. You'd have to radiation harden all your electronics to give it a shot. And that's something we do today. Air Force One is highly hardened. You know, a lot of these command and control infrastructure for our military is hardened. Now, whether it could survive an EMP right next to it, that's a good question. I'm not sure if they can handle that. So it would be a good question, because the problem with an exosuit is if it gets too heavy, you can't move, right? So you're going to have to compromise somewhere. So what's most important? Is it the armor? Is it your ability to help you move? Because I've seen that where they're kind of in a motion assist. So you move your arm and it provides extra force. Iron Man takes it a little to the extreme because the forces acting on him are quite extreme. And so even if the suit was strong enough to help him out, some of the accelerations when he's flying and whatnot would probably still hurt him. You know, the suit can't protect you from accelerations. That's still going to come through.
Can I tell you something? The thing that I marvel at with you... Oh, that was a bad choice of words. The thing that surprised me in these movies is how human beings, your basic human beings, like we'll use Tony Stark as an example. He's just a guy. He's a dude, and he's in really good shape, but he's just a dude. Doesn't have any special powers, doesn't have metal adamantium claws. He's just this dude. He puts on the suit. He can take a beating, a savage, savage beating. He can be thrown blocks into buildings, and he's like, oh, okay, let's get him. You know, it's like, how is that possible? Like conceptually in the movie, like I know the armor is a figment of our imagination, but is it absorbing shock as well? Like, is it able to cushion those blows and protect his intestines? Like when, you know, if somebody were to punch him, like just lay into him and just start punching him in the pancreas early enough, and like would hurt, right? Or is the suit protecting him? Is the suit able to stop those blows?
Well, if you think about the first Iron Man movie, when he's learning to fly and he crashes, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the suit comes with a screaming halt. Well, he's still moving inside the suit, so he's splatting inside the inside of the suit. That's going to hurt.
Yeah, well, it's just like when you get a concussion when you're wearing a football helmet.
Yeah, exactly.
The helmet stops, your head doesn't, and the brain inside your head doesn't.
Right.
So that's kind of what you're talking
about. Right, exactly. And so that's the physics that's sort of ignored mm-hmm. in these super suits.
Got it.
It's like, you know, how are you're riding around like a pinball inside the suit still. Yeah. You know, and that's still going
to
hurt.
So this is kind of to the question that you had earlier, Eddie, when you were talking about Bruce Banner becoming the Hulk. Is the human body able to, like with Captain America, when he becomes a super soldier, they just inject a serum in him and then they zap him with kind of rays. And not only does he grow in size, his muscles obviously get bigger and whatever. He's faster. He heals quicker. It's like... Is the human body capable of making those kind of adjustments?
Right.
That's on a cellular level.
Right, right. And that's kind of your basic biology question. That I don't know. I would think...
We're going to start a new podcast. Ask a biologist.
Ask a biologist.
All right, sweet. Next episode, we've got a biologist. Or if you're a biologist and can answer that, please do on our website, iHeartRocketScience.com. You can go there and leave comments, especially if you have questions about this episode or other things that we've been talking about. All right, so one last question, because I got to get these boys to bed. It is a school night. Let's talk a little bit about the vibranium. Remember we talked about asking this question to Bill about vibranium coming from outer space? So go ahead, Oliver. You got this one.
So in the Black Panther movies, in like the very, very beginning when his dad is explaining...
Talk right into the microphone.
When his dad is explaining like how Wakanda came to be, he says that there was a massive meteor that came and hit in the center in Africa and had a space element called vibranium. And my question is, could something like that happen, or has it happened in the past before?
I would like to think it's totally plausible that we have not discovered everything that's out there. Many of the elements that we have on Earth might have come from elsewhere. You think what came from the Big Bang, hydrogen, helium, right? we weren't here yet, but those came from somewhere else. So a lot of the elements we currently have very likely came from elsewhere as the Earth was congealing and forming and, you know, kind of got, you know, as the universe was getting blown around. So entirely plausible that there are other elements out there that just didn't happen across the Earth's path. Mm-hmm. Now, have we discovered something? I found an interesting question. So there's an article on Forbes that talks about how over 90% of by mass of everything on our world was at one point part of a star ejected back in interstellar space before winding back, you know, back on our planet again. So it's been around the horn.
So what you're saying is after the Big Bang, there was what, helium and hydrogen, you said?
Yeah, a lot of the...
And then so here on Earth right now, we know there's 100 and some elements, right? Like with periodic table, the elements, I don't even know what number we're at. But like, so what you're saying is beryllium wasn't necessarily naturally formed when the planet was coming together. It may have been part of space dust that was swirling around that just aggregated on the, or that just collected on the Earth.
Right.
As it was spinning and as it was solidifying.
Right, and as things congealed, they fused into the cores, lighter elements being fused into heavier ones. The formation of our, after the Big Bang, a lot of formation of the universe created these elements. So they're not necessarily inherent in just the Earth. They're out there.
Got it. So we don't know if an asteroid is hit carrying a heretofore unknown element or some kind of space dust or some kind of space virus or anything like that that maybe kickstarted life or back in the day. Right. We just don't know at this point.
We just don't know.
But it could have.
It could have. Absolutely could have. And I mean, there's some theories out there that say that we're all Martians because the catalyst for life on Earth was when something hit Earth from an asteroid, a meteor. It brought something with it. It doesn't necessarily mean it was, an evil virus or anything. It could have just been another element.
It's like you could have put all the ingredients together for cookies, but until you put a chocolate chip in, nobody wants that cookie. It doesn't matter if butterscotch, sugar, oatmeal, nobody's eating that cookie. You put a chocolate chip in it, all of a sudden you got something. So what you're saying is that's what happened on Earth.
That's one theory.
Gloop on Earth, and it was all just fine, but then one little thing came from outer space. It's like, oh, that's what we needed. Boink. Yeah, humans.
Missing ingredients.
Earth.
Could I just interrupt for a sec?
Please, can you bring this in for a landing? Can you bring some rationality to this? Because I'm just spiraling off into nothing.
Okay. So, I was kind of wondering if it's possible for things like vibranium. Like, of course, there's not going to be a metal that's exactly identical to vibranium, or all there might be. That would just, like, kind of come on over. And
I mean, just, like, it's just floating through space.
And then it's
out there.
And then it gets pulled in by our, like, magnetic force or whatever it is.
Gravity?
Gravity, yeah. Just, like, gravity itself. Shut up, Oliver.
See, Bill, I'm learning things while we do this podcast.
And so it goes, it's just, whoo, and it...
Is that what happens?
Yeah, it just slams right into Earth.
Okay.
And then, like, is it possible for, like, other space materials, is kind of what I'm saying, to be indestructible? Like, indestructible with the materials that we have on Earth. Like, it can't be broken with the materials that we have on Earth.
Excellent question. It'd be cool to find it. We have some incredibly tough materials on Earth that, you know, we don't necessarily all deal with on a daily basis.
We don't have vibranium adamantium, which is what Wolverine's claws are made out of.
Exactly.
We don't have that, but we've got some strong stuff.
There is some strong stuff that we don't run into every day, but nothing with the superpowers of, you know, vibranium and adamantium. That's the great thing about, you know, sci-fi and comic books is they can invent as they want.
Yeah.
And I was like, we need a material that can do this. Well, look at that.
Mm-hmm.
It's right over here on the shelf.
Well, okay. I got to get these kids to bed. Bill, this is fantastic. Thank you so much for coming over to the house. This has been our special Avengers Endgame edition of Ask a Rocket Scientist, our Marvel-centric ones. All right, boys. What do you have to say to Bill?
Good night.
Oliver, you have anything to chime in with there?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
See, that was nice. Look at my well-behaved boys. It's going to end as soon as I turn these microphones off. They're going to beat the crap out of each other. All right. Well, Bill, again, thank you so much for coming over. And if you are listening and you do have questions that are centered around the Marvel Universe, maybe some that we didn't get to that you're very curious about, please feel free. Hit our website, iHeartRocketScience.com. You can leave a comment or criticism or accolades for my two adorable boys. You can do that as well. And yeah, just leave us some feedback. We'd appreciate it. And also, you'll find lots of links to some of these science-based articles that we found online and YouTube videos and things like that at the website as well. iHeartRocketScience.com. Click on this particular episode, the Avengers Endgame episode, and you'll see links and connections to all kinds of information out there. Until next time, Avengers Assemble.
Ask a Rocket Scientist could be brought to you by you. Get your product or service the attention it deserves on a high-quality professional podcast. For more info, go to iHeartRocketScience.com.